Welcome to this podcast from St. Michael and All Angels Episcopal Church in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We hope you consider hitting like or subscribe. We hope you will share this audio with your friends and neighbors, help others know about our inclusive, theologically progressive community of faith. If you'd like to support our ministries, you can make a gift at stmichaelsabq.org. All right, God be with you. Let us pray. Gracious and loving one, God of the prophets, bless the prophet's heirs. Be with us this day as we seek to talk through prophecy, what it is, what it isn't, and who we are called to be in our world today. Amen.
Amen.
So I was going to do slides, but I only have about five of them. So I'm going to put them online with this talk. And if you want to look at my slides, you can look at my slides later. But half of you can't see them anyway, so we're not going to worry about them. I wanted to take a moment to talk. We're going to do two of these fora around the tiers of things, the book by Richard Rohr. And a number of us are in study groups together during the week. We do still have a little bit of room, particularly in the Monday morning group that meets right here at 8 in the morning on Monday. You're welcome to come if you'd like. Or on our Zoom sessions, which are going to be at noon on Tuesdays. If you want to join the Monday group, just show up. If you want to come to Zoom, send me an email. I'll shoot you the link. But that's where a lot of the discussion is happening around the tiers of things. So I'm going to lean a little bit more on the teaching side today. I'll make some room for questions at the end, but I'm going to lean a little bit into teaching today because there's so much discussion happening out in the group. It's sort of like being in an undergraduate seminar and you've got your lecture section and then your discussion sections, if you can remember that, or many of you were actually professors. So this is a little bit more the lecture section, but there is some room for questions. So I want to spend a moment with something Rohr says in The Tiers of Things. Rohr says prophets are, by definition, those rare individuals who see reality in its fullness and dimension rather than in dualities like totally right or totally wrong, all good or all bad. I want to spend some time this morning looking at the biblical and theological vocation of the prophet as the one who feels, speaks, and enacts God's grief and God's hope in history. And so I want to make sure that you're aware of a couple of voices in this conversation, two that Richard Rohr points to directly. He does this in the acknowledgement section. But there are two really important voices about the prophets in the 20th and then into the 21st century. The first I get a little bit nervous talking about because my predecessor, Joe, had his PhD, his dissertation was on Abraham Joshua Heschel. And so in some ways, I mean, I get a little imposter syndrome talking about Abraham Joshua Heschel. Maybe we should invite Joe back to talk about him sometime. But Abraham Joshua Heschel is an Orthodox scholar, a writer who becomes this very influential voice in the culture, and who helps us recontextualize who the prophets are and to understand how the Jewish community living today apprehends the prophetic texts. The other voice that Richard points to as really important for the understanding of the prophets is a scholar named Walter Brueggemann. And I wouldn't be a good, at one point, St. Louisan without saying Walter Brueggemann has a St. Louis connection. Walter Brueggemann started his career at Eden Seminary in St. Louis. He went on to be its academic dean, had a very important career, probably one of the most important scholars of the Hebrew Bible in Christianity in the 20th and even into the 21st century. Walter Brueggemann helps us to see the prophet as a poetic voice of resistance and alternative consciousness. And then finally, from those two, we'll talk a little bit about Richard Rohr, about what it means to have a contemplative and pastoral lens on prophetic suffering and solidarity. So let's talk for a minute first about Heschel, about Abraham Joshua Heschel. And if you see the slides later, you'll see the picture I have of Abraham Joshua Heschel has him marching with Dr. King. So Heschel, for Heschel, one of the most important things to know about prophets is that they feel the pathos of God. The pathos of God. What does that mean? What is pathos of God? Anybody?
The heart,
the emotion, yeah. Heschel has this idea, and this is his big work on the prophets. It was originally published in two volumes, but now somebody's put it together in one cover with too small print. Heschel helps us to see the prophets differently than the way we often have seen the prophets. Richard Rohr gets into this a little bit, though I was grateful in the Tears of Things. Richard didn't start with the old saw that I've heard again and again and again in the church, which is that the prophets are not prognosticators, right? For a very long time, and Richard does this in a very nuanced way, which I really appreciate, but Heschel is part of who helps us see this for the first time. In Christianity especially, prophets were often sort of taught as the people who guessed the future or for whom God sent visions of the future. And there's a tiny bit of that in the prophets, but it's nothing like what we made of it. So how do we do this in Christianity particularly? How is that suddenly the thing? What way do we use the prophets the most in Christianity? What season do we read the most prophets? Anybody?
Advent.
Advent, right? We read particularly Isaiah as if Isaiah was telling the future coming of Jesus, right? And that is the lens through which a lot of Christians see the prophets. Particularly Isaiah, but for a long time, that's really kind of the way the church used the prophets, was to say, there are things in these prophetic texts that we think point to Jesus. And so let us talk to you about who Jesus was. And what that does is it ignores the prophets and their own situations and their own setting in life and the whole teaching that they were trying to do. Making the prophets be some forerunner to Jesus fails to take the prophets on their own terms. And what Abraham Joshua Heschel does that is so profound is to talk about the prophets as, quote, some of the most disturbing people who ever lived. It's often not fun to read the prophets. I thought Amos was grumpy last week, and then we got this week's text, right? The prophets are often in the mode of lamentation. But what Heschel asks us to see, invites us to see, is that the prophets are feeling the emotions of God. And Heschel invites us to see a God who is emotionally involved in history, in the life of the people, who cares about what is happening. Now, we know that that's true. We've read, at least in Exodus, the call of Moses, where God says to Moses, I have heard the cries of my people, and so I'm sending you, Moses. But what Heschel asks us to do is to see these sometimes larger than life emotions of the prophets as part of the emotional life of God. So the prophet's empathy is with God's people and with God's suffering in injustice. The prophet, Heschel says, hears God's voice and feels God's heart. So that's Heschel, and that's Heschel in a very much a nutshell. And there is this sense for which understanding that anger is part of the emotional life of God is important for Heschel. Now, anger being part of the emotional life of God is a little tricky for Christians, right? Particularly Christians living in late 20th and early 21st century America, where we have that, you know, most of us read that sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. We tend to think God is angry at us as individuals, right? That God is angry at something we did. Usually it has something to do with sex, right? But that there's some kind of very individualistic piece to God's anger. And what you have to know is that for Heschel, God's anger doesn't function on that level. God's anger is about justice. God's anger comes about because God's people are being denied justice. It's what we heard again in Amos today about trampling on the poor. That the natural consequence of injustice in our world is the anger of God. But that anger isn't usually directed at one person. Sometimes the king. It's never good to be a king in the land of the prophets, right? There is this famous tension between prophets and kings. But so sometimes the king becomes the focus of the prophet and of God's anger. In Exodus, of course, it's Pharaoh, right? Go tell old Pharaoh to let my people go. Pharaoh becomes the focus of God's anger, but it is the situation of injustice, the corporate situation that gives rise to that anger and gives rise to the lament, that pathos of God, anger and sadness, anger and frustration, anger and sorrow are often mixed up in the prophets. But it's really important to hear, unless you are a king, you don't have to worry too much about God being angry at you as an individual. It is God's anger at the situation and God's hope that that situation can be transformed. And that's where the prophet sits. We'll move next to Walter Brueggemann. Now, Walter Brueggemann, in many ways, incorporates, often quotes Abraham Joshua Heschel. But Walter Brueggemann has a couple of insights into the life of the prophet that have really taken hold in our world today, in our sense of who the prophets were. And Walter Brueggemann talks about two sides of the work of the prophet. It's really the same work, but there are two sides. The work, the book that Walter Brueggemann is most famous for this is called The Prophetic Imagination. That's the one that Richard quotes the most. We'll get to the imagination piece, but to get there, you have to hear first the disruptive character of the prophets for Brueggemann. For Brueggemann, the first vocation of the prophet is to disrupt the dominant consciousness. To disrupt the dominant consciousness. Brueggemann often calls this the royal consciousness, right? And that is to say that the royal consciousness is the consciousness of empire. It's the way of looking at the world, the lens of looking at the world that serves the empire. If you have an old copy of Walter Brueggemann's book, it is worth your time to go and find one of the updated editions. There is a, it's one of those wonderful things in theological scholarship when you can watch a conversation happening over time. But in his, I think it's in the second edition, Walter Brueggemann adds a preface, as they always do. But it's fun because he adds a preface where he quotes a scholar who quotes him a great deal. And so you can see this conversation happening. But the scholar he quotes is a guy named William Kavanaugh. And William Kavanaugh is a liturgical scholar. His important book is called Torture and Eucharist, which is not about how long the service lasts. William Kavanaugh's book, Torture and Eucharist, looks at the way that the Eucharistic community existed in Chile under Pinochet. And And Brueggemann, in his preface, uses Kavanaugh, who uses Brueggemann throughout his book, talking about imagination and talking about naming royal consciousness. Brueggemann talks about the power of storytelling. And he says, in Chile, under Pinochet, the people were being told their lives did not matter. Their voices had no value. They had no ability to stand up for justice, to care for one another. The only voice that mattered in Chile in those days was Pinochet's and the people around him. This is autocracy. This is empire, right? And that was the story that was told to the people. Your voice doesn't matter. The voice that matters is the dictator's. Listen to him. What he says is what is best for Chile. Make Chile great again. And Kavanaugh says that in the midst of that environment, the Eucharist became a totally different thing. In the midst of that environment, the bishops started talking more and more about Eucharist as a place where all of the people who gathered around the table mattered, where every voice was included. The story of the Eucharist was an alternative way of seeing, an alternative way of enacting, and an alternative way of imagining the people's place in a society. Pinochet and his generals used torture to silence the people. The church, simply by gathering, blessing, breaking bread, and sharing it, told a different story, reminded people that they were valued. And in his preface to the second edition, Brueggemann says, what William Kavanaugh has named is the prophetic imagination. It is an imagination that helps us to see not the world as it is, not merely how to survive, but the world as it could be, the world as it should be. Brueggemann says the power of the prophets is not in simply the lament, but you have to know that that lament is serving to disrupt the royal consciousness, the way of empire, the propaganda that is surrounding the people, that lament that is so present in the prophets is a tool to move you into the space of imagining a future where people are treated with their inherent dignity, where their rights and their voices are valued, where they are invited around the table. And Brueggemann says that in the face of empire, this process of lament, hope, and then doxology, offering praise to God, it offers new language. The prophet's power lies in imagination, not coercion. Speech and hope, not power over. Prophecy, then, is the ability to do as Harvey Milk said in the streets of San Francisco, you gotta give them hope, right? So that's Brueggemann. And so those are the two voices that Richard points to most as framing his understanding of prophecy. The Orthodox scholar who marched in the streets with Dr. King and talked about the pathos of God, and the Protestant scholar who said that the power of the prophets is to hear God's imagination, God's dream for the world, as Desmond Tutu often called it, breaking open over and against the story that the empire wants to tell. And that's where Richard comes in. And he talks about prophecy and suffering and the tears of things. So Richard's contribution in this conversation, in some ways, is to take it away from the thick academic tomes Though I will say this book by Heschel really is very approachable and is worth your time, though you might need a magnifying glass or the two-volume edition. But it's beautifully written, well done. Walter Brueggemann's Prophetic Imagination as well. Pretty accessible as scholarly text goes. But this is something that Richard Rohr is actually a master at. He takes a conversation that is happening and invites the average person into that conversation to ask, what does this have to do with me? And Richard, in this prophetic conversation about the tears of things, invites us first into that question of pathos. Really invites us into, how do we feel the feelings right now in a world that feels like it has gone so wrong? I named some of the what's going wrong in the world in my sermon. We will be talking in the groups about the pain that we're seeing in the world, the pain that we're feeling in the world. I sent out an e-noticias and have sent to the groups as well, a spiritual practice about slowing down enough just to feel the feelings that the folks at the CAC put together in response to Richard's book, but allowing there to be the space for the tears of things. There's a poet that I really, really like named Andrea Gibson. She just died earlier this month. Incredible younger poet, and they pronouns, actually. Andrea Gibson used they pronouns at their death. Died of cancer. But there's a line, Andrea Gibson struggled on and off with depression, anxiety, lots that went on for Andrea. But they owned their tears a lot. And I'd really encourage you to, if you get a chance, they can be a little crass, which I love. My favorite collection of their poetry is called Pole Dancing to Gospel Hymns. But Andrea Gibson has this line where they say, I cry as often as some people pee. Right? But to be invited to embrace those tears and to see that as a radical thing in and of itself in a time when lament can become political, when feeling the emotions can be disruptive, to unbury the hidden sorrow beneath the world's facades. One of my favorite Richardisms, there's a lot of Richard Rohr-isms, right? But one of my favorite Richardisms is that you don't worry about when you get disillusioned, because to be disillusioned is simply to lose your illusions, right? But to be disillusioned with the world is to say there are a lot of illusions being presented right now, and we need to open those up. We need to feel the tears of things. And so the prophetic task is not to escape suffering, but to enter it consciously, intentionally, knowing that the suffering, in the language of the prophets, is what allows us to move toward hope, toward imagination. That you don't get to the other side without going through those emotions. Richard also talks about it a lot in that process of order, disorder, reorder. You don't get to the new order. You don't get to the new way of imagining the world. You don't get to the place God dreams for us without disordering what we thought was ordered, without that disruption. So Brueggemann's emphasis of that disruption is there, but it's that disruption of numbness, that grief itself can be political. So Rohr adds, probably better than the other two touch on it, but Rohr asks us to consider the interior dimensions of these teachings. That prophecy is transformative of the society, yes, but also of the self. Rohr invites us to see the levels on which we participate in systems that we think are ordered, but really we need to work to disorder. And Rohr invites us to see that on a number of levels. The societal and political, absolutely. But the family system, and even in our own life. Can't tell you the number of people in this church that I've talked to that have read Richard's book on the 12 steps. and would say that that may be one of the most important books that he wrote, right? Breathing Underwater, right? But it's this sense of, in our own lives, those orders need to be disrupted. The things that we thought were holy and untouchable, there's very little of that actually in the world that doesn't need reimagining. So the question then becomes, if this is the biblical frame for prophecy, if the biblical frame for prophecy are the people who disrupt the status quo, as Heschel said, some of the most disturbing people you'll ever meet, but disturbing is held in a, you know, like high regard in this sense, because you're disturbing an imperial status quo that is not serving the people. If that is what prophecy is, then who are the prophets today? Where are the prophets today? And so, I mean, we could do that assignment, right? Like, let's name some prophets from today. Say it. Colbert. Here's the thing about Stephen Colbert. It's the same thing that happens to the prophet Jeremiah. If you try to cancel him, he just comes back stronger. See how a network does, as if, you know, like talk about old technology. We'll see how that goes. Poppy.
Rachel Maddow.
The thing that I would caution around Rachel Maddow, and a place that I see Colbert is in a slightly different place, is that prophetic imagination tends to move beyond the binaries, as Richard says, the dualities. And one of the places that I see prophets is in a place where even the politicians that think that you're going to be on their side get confounded by you. And so I do value Rachel Maddow's voice a lot. But there's a story about Desmond Tutu. I'm going to talk about he's now died a few years, been dead a few years, but Desmond Tutu, for a lot of my life, I thought of as a prophet, right? One of the key moments in Desmond Tutu's ministry, in my mind, is what happened after he got Nelson Mandela out of jail. You know this story? So Nelson Mandela comes off of Robben Island. The first night of freedom, he actually spends at Bishopthorpe, at Desmond Tutu's house in Cape Town. Desmond is the Archbishop of Cape Town at this point. And so they're close, they're friends, we know this. Desmond Tutu is largely responsible for keeping the movement going when so many of the political figures have been arrested. Desmond Tutu gets the Nobel Prize for this work. And Nelson Mandela also gets a Nobel Prize for this work against apartheid, right? And you would think they're thick as thieves. And Nelson Mandela, after freedom, I think even after he won the presidency, came to Desmond Tutu and said, okay, when are you joining the ANC, the African National Congress, the political party that Mandela and the folks who struggled against apartheid created and won the election in a landslide? And Desmond Tutu said, oh no, I'm never joining the ANC. Now that you're in power, it's my job to hold you accountable. Right? And so that independence of a voice is really important. And one of the things that worries me about our world right now is that it has become, like, the way that we think of media companies even has become so partisan, right? And that, like, what we saw this week with the defunding of NPR and PBS was framed as, well, they're Democratic. They're on the side of the DNC. And those media folks work really hard, and I would say Rachel Maddow doesn't work quite as hard, to have the independent voice, right? But I know a lot of folks in the NPR world, in the PBS world, that really work to maintain that independent voice That's one of the geniuses of our Constitution, the protection of the press alongside religion. But I would say that prophecy still tends to sit with spiritual voices a little bit more than broadcasters. One of the things I see about Stephen Colbert is that Colbert is a surprisingly spiritual figure. Colbert really brought James Martin onto the consciousness of the world stage, and that Jesuit has done a whole lot with Colbert's support. But Colbert has brought this, his very progressive Catholic identity, into the way he does things. He would also tell you that, like, if you're going to him to get the news, you're doing it wrong, right? Like, he is a comedian, and comedians and prophets are often close together.
John Lewis.
Yeah, there's a situation where, and the Black church is fascinating in this, right? Because the line between a pastor and a politician in the Black church doesn't exist, right? Look at the junior senator from Georgia, right? The Black church, in some ways, because it has always been in a minority position, has always held the prophetic together with the political. They've always seen that politics has to serve alongside work to set God's people free. Now, then the fights happen in the Black church sometimes around, like, women's voices and the inclusion of LGBTQ plus people, and where the lines are there, because oppression is something that happens across all sorts of society. But John Lewis is somebody who first was an activist, first was making good trouble, and then worked to bring that good trouble into Congress. And there are other figures like that.
James Baldwin.
Pope Leo, we will see. I'm praying, the verdict's still out on Pope Leo for me. Pope Francis at his best.
One thing, I don't want to give you a name, but this to me is courage. Prophets have courage.
Yeah.
I don't even get sometimes. Like, I'd love to put a bumper sticker on my truck.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid to. I'm afraid that I'll come out and all the windows will be busted out.
Yeah.
But prophets don't even think that.
Well, they didn't even want to be prophets.
They don't even want to be prophets. Yeah, there's a lot of reluctance in the prophets, isn't there? You see that a lot. I mean, last week Amos was telling us, I'm just a dresser of sycamore trees, right? So somebody brought up Bishop Buddy, Marianne Buddy. Talk about a prophetic moment, right? The funny thing is, like, Bishop Buddy and I were ordained in the same year. Well, she's been priesthood a lot longer, but she was consecrated Bishop of Washington the same year I was made a priest. Actually, I don't know, maybe in the same month, within a month of each other. And so we worked together really closely, and I know her really well. And so it is something to see somebody, you know, like when you've done dishes in their kitchen, standing in the pulpit of the National Cathedral, like, and then there's, like, t-shirts afterward. I've got one, Bishop Buddy fan club, right? But I've been a fan since, and she's still, I've told Bishop Michael this, but she raised the bar for what a bishop is for me at the beginning of my ministry in incredible ways. But she's written a book about courage, and it's exactly what you're talking about, Bill. It's like, courage is a key part of what it means to live prophetically, and choosing to exercise courage in very particular ways and particular moments. She knows this, we've talked about this, but I was angry at her in the first Trump administration when he waved that Bible upside down in front of the church I worked at. There was a real debate within the Diocese of Washington about whether they should sue him for trespassing. Technically, he was on their property without their permission. And it was Mary Ann's decision not to do it. And I was upset about that. I thought they should sue. And if they had, there's no way he ever would have been sitting in that pew for her to deliver that sermon. Right? And so She kept her powder dry and then used it. I'm not sure right now whether all of the institutions that are kind of holding back and waiting for their courageous moment are doing that as wisely. But there is that sense of courage that is, and she talks about that decision in her book, right? But there is that sense of courage that is an important part of prophets. Any other prophets you want to talk about, characteristics of prophets in our day?
What do you think?
Who do I think? You know, it's interesting because Brueggemann's idea about the prophets as poets has me held in some interesting ways. You know, when I think about prophetic moments, I think about like Amanda Gorman's poem at Biden's inauguration. Not because it was Biden's inauguration, but because of the vision that it cast of what America can be, right? That at this moment when we were all paying close attention, somebody broke through and said, yes, and this, right? I would say the same about Langston Hughes. I posted on social media on the 4th of July, we were up in Canada, which was kind of beautiful. I was grateful not to be around my dog stealing with the fireworks, right? But I got thinking about that Langston Hughes poem about let America be America, the land that never has been yet and yet must be, the land where everyone is free. And then Langston Hughes says, America never was America for me. Right? It's this poetic invitation into who can we be as a people. That, I think, is one of the pieces of prophecy that is so very important. Which is why I think, by the way, that Marianne's sermon, Bishop Marianne's sermon, was a moment of prophecy, because what she was doing in a moment when the royal consciousness was very much on display was to disrupt that and to say, no, we still need to be, we still can be a place for immigrants, for LGBT people, for trans kids. Those people still have a place in our society. She was imagining the world as it ought to be. And so that's why I sit with that prophetic moment. And I would say some of the poets captured that for me as well. Dana.
Along those lines, you know, I think of Mary Oliver, just in the power of observation.
Yeah.
Because if I'm, like, for example, up in my head thinking, I'm not noticing the sunflower or the person on the corner of the street. And I read somebody said she is one of her just amazing skills is that there's never been anybody that's written so much about nature that makes you think about people.
Yeah, never been somebody who's written that much about nature who makes you think about people. And thanks for bringing up Mary Oliver, because where I want to bring us in conclusion, and then I'll take some general questions, but is to a place of becoming a prophetic people. To understand that we often, and the Bible is partly to blame for this because we name the books based on the people, right? And Richard points out that we don't have books for the seven women that are regarded as prophets as well in the Bible. We should. But when you do that, you kind of make it seem like the prophet is an office that somebody holds, like only certain people count. And part of what Richard's inviting us to is to become a prophetic people. That remembering that prophecy is not about predicting the future. We could do a whole thing about how they used to do that in the biblical times. It was gruesome. This is not about predicting the future, but about feeling God's pain, disrupting illusions, and offering hope. And so we're invited to this prophetic consciousness to feel deeply, to be present, and to observe. I mean, part of why Mary Oliver is such a good example of this is because she spent basically every morning in her muck boots walking through the woods, scribbling in notebooks, and only tiny fragments of what she wrote and what she did turned into poetry, right? She practiced that observation intensely. You have to practice that level of observation to produce the kind of lines that she produced, right? But to get in there and make that space to see what is going on, to notice what is going on, and to feel deeply what is going on. For Brueggemann, it's also about speaking truth imaginatively. Richard brings this up, but we've all been in those conversations with the people who can drop just like one line and change the whole room, right? I am a person of way too many words, so I love those moments of economy with words. That's why the poets I admire so much, right? But that to speak the truth imaginatively is a very important part of what we do. And as Christians, as people who look to the prophets, when we are in spaces where lament and where duality and binaries are present, there are spaces where you have to polarize, right? There are spaces where, in order to do justice, there have to be polarities. You have to be able to say, are you with us or against us? You have to be able to go to the politician's office and say, we demand this. And if you don't do it, we're going to organize the voters to vote against you, right? There have to be those polarities. But to engage those with a prophetic lens is to do it with a level of imagination, is to do it with a level of openness that is different. And then Richard would also invite you to think about how you live compassionately. How do you allow this frame of prophecy to shape how you engage with the people in your day-to-day life? One more Desmond Tutu story about that. I've told this before, but Desmond Tutu, like a lot of these guys that get invited to go be big speakers places, had a little rider. Like if you were inviting Desmond Tutu to come, you had to do certain things, and it wasn't like have a whole bowl of green M&Ms, right? But he did say he needed several hours each day for private prayer. He's needed morning prayer and evening prayer. He needed time in the middle of the day. And often, and especially in like Episcopal churches that knew him well, they'd be like, can't you make an exception for us? Can't you? And Desmond Tutu would say, if you want the Desmond Tutu that you know, if you want the Desmond Tutu who laughs and makes people feel included and makes people feel seen and heard, you gotta give me my time to pray. Yeah. You gotta give me my time to recharge. That level of engaging with people and compassion requires a certain level of commitment to the interior life. And so there is this sense in which the invitation to be a prophetic people has implications for how we spend our time, how we engage with the news. Often that means not going through every single headline, reading every single story, but allowing the stories that start to touch our emotions to actually go there, setting down the newspaper and feeling the sensations of grief and anger, feeling what they feel like in our body. And from those places of feeling, to begin to speak truth in ways that are imaginative, that make room for change. So that's the kind of conversation about prophets around Richard Rohr. We've got just a couple minutes, and then I gotta go do another service. So if there are any questions, Marian. The Dalai Lama, yeah, I would say there's a prophetic. I mean, like, the Dalai Lama wouldn't frame himself in the frame of the Hebrew prophets, right? But part of what, if you ever need a moment after the news and you happen to be in front of some kind of device that has the internet in it, which these days when we're reading the news, most of us are, just put into the YouTube search Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu laughing. There are all these videos of the two of them just cackling together. And I would say that laughter is in and of itself sort of prophetic. Maya Angelou, another poet. Brené Brown. Yeah, at her best.
Eleanor Roosevelt never lost sight of what America could be.
Yep.
She died on
Eleanor Roosevelt was like incredibly ahead of her time and an incredibly complex character. If you haven't read Pauline Murray's Song in a Weary Throat, and some of Pauline Murray's poetry is incredibly prophetic as well, but her descriptions of her relationship with Eleanor Roosevelt and how Eleanor Roosevelt was incredibly politically astute, but was also at times a creature of the social class to which she had been born into. And you can see some of that complexity in Polly's writings about her.
Just a quick thought about being creative.
Yeah.
At some point, I don't know the year, but the Ku Klux Klan was walking up Pretty March in Greensboro, North
yep.
Carolina. And so a group got together, put on clown suits, and joined the march.
Oh.
as the Ku Klux Klan is going, white power, white power. The clowns are going, white
flower, white flower. They tossed around. And the Ku Klux Klan went home. Yeah. Yeah. The other thing about prophets is they always loved the people that they were talking to. Yeah. They loved the people they were talking to. Sometimes not the king. I mean, they loved the king, but there was a lot of critique. But definitely they loved the people God loved. That's part of that pathos, that the anger of God is tied to the love of God.
Cesar Chavez.
Cesar Chavez. Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, all of these characters are going to be complex, too. And all of the prophets were complex as well. This week in the groups, we'll talk about Richard's chapter about the unfinished prophets as well, the ones that don't make it through lament to imagination. And Richard, I found that chapter one of the more provocative ones in the book. Particularly because he names John the Baptist as unfinished, right? And there's some beauty to that, right? Richard's inviting us to consider what is the full work of prophecy, and is it finished if we don't have that vision of hope?
Maybe it's Richard Rohr. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Though he'd be embarrassed to hear it. So.
We don't haven't mentioned too many live people.
Yeah.
So I just wonder if prophets are without honor in their own country in their own time, or if they're just aren't.
Sure. No.
I would say too. I think there is. We live in a time where there has been a lot of what I would call prophetic unveiling, of some of the ways in which very big public figures have. Fallen short, right? To put it in a gracious way. And so I think it's very rare. I only know of one case, and it was Desmond Tutu, that the church would ever consider somebody as a saint before they're dead, because you kind of want the verdict to be done, right? Desmond Tutu had cancer, and the rumor was that he was going to die, and so an Episcopal church in San Francisco, St. Gregory of Nyssa, had him painted into a mural of the dancing saints on the wall, and then Desmond Tutu lived another 20 years. Yeah, it was prophetic, right? But it's that kind of clarity while somebody is still alive is rare. It's very rare. Desmond Tutu is not yet on the front of Westminster Abbey. And then Westminster Abbey, it's the martyrs of the 20th century, right? But like Oscar Romero and Martin Luther King are up there as martyrs. So that's one.
I have to say John Lennon.
John Lennon. Yeah, imagine all the people. Imagine no religion. Dorothy Day. We could do this all day, right? But you get a little bit of a sense. And don't lose. If a prophet is a prophet, they should disturb you, right? That's one of the signs you've got prophecy going on and not just the kind of political consensus, right? Prophets disturb us. And so it is important to ask, how is this person asking me to imagine the world differently than the slogans I can download from my political party of choice, what more is being offered? Because God's vision is always, always, always going to be bigger and wider than ours. I have to leave it there because I gotta go do another service. Thank you all so much.